Today on Dolby Creator Talks, we welcome back cinematographer Greg Fraser to discuss his stunning work in Dune Part 2. You may remember we've had Greg on the podcast a few times to talk about his work on The Batman and, of course, Dune Part 1, for which Greg won his very first Academy Award. And it is no wonder why. If you haven't seen Dune Part 2 yet, it is visually stunning. Today we're going to break down just how he and his team pulled it all off. So be forewarned, there are going to be some mild spoilers ahead, but we will do our best not to give too much away. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, I strongly suggest that you hit pause on this podcast and go to your nearest Dolby Cinema, where you can see the movie in Dolby Vision and Dolby Atmos. Also, if you like this episode and you simply need more things Dune this week, be sure to check out our upcoming conversation with legendary composer Hans Zimmer, which we will be posting in just a few days. But for right now, let's hear from cinematographer Greg Fraser. Greg, thanks for coming back on the Dolby podcast and talking to us about Dune Part 2. But before we jump into that, I just wanted to say we had Edward Lachman on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about El Conde. And as I was preparing for that discussion, I found your interview with him for ASC Clubhouse. And you did such a great job on that interview. There was so much great stuff in there. And I think more than anything else, like, your admiration and respect for him really came through in that conversation.
I know this is a conversation about Dune, but like, Ed Lachman is like a legend, and everything he does, he's a bit of a role model in the sense that he changes, he pivots and changes, and his style changes, and he builds a world, and he's true to that world. So no, I had a great time talking to him. I learned a lot, actually.
Well, I was just about to say, you know, Greg, if the cinematography thing doesn't work out for you, you know, you might have a future as a podcaster.
I've got a job there with you guys. Great.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was really fantastic. All right. Dune Part 2. I wanted to dive into the conversation with you about this by just asking about your preparation process and kind of what's happening for you in pre-production, because I think a lot of people are focused on what happens on set when you're actually shooting with the actors. But I'm kind of curious, for you, especially on Dune Part 2, what kind of puzzles did you have to figure out during the prep process? How do you use that testing period? What's going on for you in that time?
It was a very interesting prep period, let me tell you, because we had this little thing called the Academy Awards slap bang right in the middle of it. And listen, I like an awards show as much as the next person. And, but it was a pretty crazy time because it was a crazy time, but we were prepping in the middle of all these awards. So it was literally like we were sitting at a table. I remember we're at one of the critics awards, and I was sitting next to Denis and Javier actually. And we were talking about Javier's scenes, like in between, you know, like everyone's kind of serving the dinner, and we're sitting talking around about Dune Part 2 in the middle of the awards show. And then, you know, then it's like, okay, award. And then Hans gets an award. Oh, Hans super gets an award. Like, so it was a very, very surreal experience that I'm sure won't be repeated. But it was great because we got to be talking about something that we hadn't shot whilst promoting or talking about something that we had shot and that was being, you know, being, I don't know, appreciated, I guess. So it was cool. The good thing on a practical level about doing a part two of the same story was, you know, whenever you do a movie, you've got to solve a series of problems. And those problems often, some of them are technical, some of them are a bit boring, like how do you get a bit of equipment to a certain place, like stuff that you don't really ever want to talk about in these things. And then there are creative discussions about talking about the what ifs and all those things. And a lot of the technical stuff had been solved for us in advance because we'd done part one. And so this allowed us the opportunity to kind of dream a little bit. And I wouldn't say dream bigger, but it allowed us to dream with more opportunity, you know, and it didn't come down to more money or time or anything like that. It wasn't about that. It was about that we felt empowered that we were doing the right thing. At least people were appreciating the job that we had done. And instead of having that paralyze us, I felt it kind of went, all right, we've done all right now. We've ticked the box. We've done what we need to do. Let's be a little more, a little more kind of, not crazy, but a little more kind of bold, you know? So we were able to make bold decisions and bold choices, like the, you know, the infrared photography on Getty Prime and you know, the eclipse scene. So we were able to do that a little more, a little bit more boldly.
Well, since you brought it up, I do want to dive into the Getty Prime sequence, which was just stunning to me. And you mentioned the infrared camera. That's a whole new, I mean, both films are so bold visually, but the Getty Prime sequence is just stunning. And I'd love for you to talk about kind of your conversations with Denis about how you guys wanted that to look, how you arrived at the infrared camera. That gladiator sequence where we see Fade Rotha for the first time is just extraordinary.
It was a funny conversation because we hadn't met Fade before, you know, and also we hadn't seen Getty Prime in the daytime, really. Like we'd seen other planets in the daytime. We'd seen obviously Arrakis in the daytime, but we hadn't really seen Getty Prime in the daytime. And the danger really was that Getty Prime in the daytime was going to look like Arrakis. I mean, that's the real reality, is because you light two scenes with sunlight, and you're in a stadium that sure is a bit grayer, but it's still got sand. And sure, the sand might be white, but not like, you know, but it's ultimately like there are similarities there. And so Denis was like, well, why don't we do this in black and white? And we're like, great, let's be bold. You know, like, let's be bold. Let's do it in black and white. But then I remembered some techniques that I've been using for a few years, because I get a little bit geeky into the sciences. I try not to be too geeky on set. I try and be the artiste, and I try and be a little bit like, you know, but there are definitely some science manuals that I kind of read about. You know, I also studied photography and the physics of photography and light and all that. And so I understand a little bit about the way, you know, visible light works and non-visible light works, and, you know, gamma rays and x-rays and infrared. And so I realized that these cameras actually record infrared, and it's a problem because these camera manufacturers, it bleeds into the colors. So camera manufacturers solve it by putting a infrared filter. But I realized that if you take that filter off and then put a visible light cut filter in, then you end up seeing the only thing you see is infrared. And the only time that we ever experience infrared is when we're looking at our security cameras at night. You know, if when you're looking at your doorbell camera, when your porch light's not on and you've got somebody come to your door and you see that kind of really odd looking, you know, ghoulish kind of face. I mean, I got to say, like, none of us look, you know, very good in that sort of light, because we all look a little bit ghoulish. And I said to Denis, well, listen, if we're thinking about black and white, why don't we consider this technique? And I did a little test and showed him, and he was like, that's it. Let's just do that. So we decided to do that. We shot outside in the daytime in Hungary in the middle of summer. So I think Austin's talked about that a little bit because it was hot, 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 hot. But yeah, we shot that, and we shot that with the infrared camera.
Help me understand that. So was that you're saying that the Alexa that you shot with actually captures infrared that you normally throw out? So was it actually a different camera, or were you just using the Alexa without the filters?
No, we were using the Alexa without the filter that they use to solve the problem of infrared bleed. So we took that out. So now the camera is going to see everything from blue, not ultraviolet. Doesn't see ultraviolet. It's blue right through to infrared, but which is doesn't look great. I mean, maybe it looks great for something else. We'll be talking again in 5 years, and I will have shot something like that. So, and you'll bring up a clip of me saying it doesn't look very good, and I'll be like, oh, that's a mistake. But then you cut the visible light so that all the colors that you see on this screen and you see around you, the blue and the green and the red, disappears. So the camera doesn't see anything that we see with our eyes. It only sees infrared light.
Well, and to your point, you probably found the only human being on the planet that would still look good even when in infrared.
I mean, Austin Butler's we're pretty blessed to have the handsome Austin Butler to look kind of incredible under that light.
So you get the script, you read Paul Rides a Sandworm. Tell me about the approach to figuring out you know, one of the things that is, I think is really noteworthy about the Dune films is the seamlessness between the CGI and the practical effects and the on-set photography. So tell me about trying to just the puzzle of sorting out that sequence and figuring out how to capture Paul riding the sandworm.
I mean, I was thinking about trying to say something funny, like, well, the last time I rode a sandworm, this is how it felt, which is obviously ridiculous because we haven't all ridden a sandworm in years, right? Since we were young. But you read that in the script and you go, Paul rides a sandworm. And the first time you read it, I read it and I just glossed over it because I was enthralled in the story. And then I went back and I went, holy heck, how do we shoot him riding a sandworm? Because we have I have no point of reference for that. Like I can't imagine it. I can't, like, there's nothing that I can look at. I can't look at paintings. I can't look at old videos shot. I just can't. Nothing. So I set about finding reference that might be right. You know, we set some rules. We said, okay, even though we're on a sandworm, the cameras have to be real. They have to be either on the sandworm with him. We have to be a camera operator strapped to a sandworm. We have to imagine ourselves as a camera operator. We have to pretend that we're on another sandworm, riding along the same distance, and we're on a super long lens and we're trying to capture it and we're having a hard time framing it. But we tried to be really honest with our lensing. You know, we tried to have a basis in honesty every time we put a lens on that character. And I felt like that was kind of the most, at the time, I felt like that was the best way because we had no point of reference. You know, I found some fantastic references of some surfing, some going into the ocean, being drowned, like going through waves, you know, hitting a wave and going into the wave and, like, you know, skiing down off piste with avalanche coming at you and, you know, like tons of GoPro footage and, you know, tons of that stuff, you know, water skiing. And all added up, we all kind of went, okay, this is how it should be. Like, if we're going to see him at a distance with this behemoth that surrounds him, this is how we shoot it. If we're with him, we're shooting like from the back of a boat on a water skier. Like, you know, we're kind of honest about the way we shot it. And I think you'll find every kind of shot has a premise of reality. And it's funny, that scene though, I love, because it took a long time to shoot. We knew that each shot for that was going to take us a long time. So what we did is we divided and conquered the unit. We had, Denise storyboarded, you know, we set the tests, we did all the testing. Tanya LaPointe, who's our executive producer, handled the represented Denis on that set. Christoph Brandl was my DP representative, and we were all kind of always in communication about the shots and about achieving the shots. And, you know, I still watch that scene and, you know, it's funny talking about Hans Zimmer before, like I still watch that scene and my favorite shot in that scene is Paul stands up. He just gets up, his legs shaking, and he stands up. I think that's Denis' favorite shot, is where he stands up from behind. My favorite shot is the profile of him. He's up and he's full body, and I think it's plus him. And whatever Hans has done, whatever note he has put in for that moment makes I explode. Like every time I've air pumped. Every time I've watched it, and this is me sitting in a grading suite by myself with one other guy who's thinking I'm a dick, you know, like just, yeah, I'm air punching because of Hans's score combined with all of that stuff.
We will make sure to ask Hans about that when we have him on the show.
You can tell him of my admiration as a fanboy. I was fanboyed out when I watched that scene. I knew those images like the back of my hand because I'd studied them and we shot them. But that shot, when it comes up, I was like, high-fiving the air.
I really appreciate what you were saying earlier about just the truthfulness of the cinematography. Obviously, there's very few movies out in the world right now operating on the size and scale of Dune. But one of the reasons why it feels so impactful, I think, is because you don't do impossible camera shots. You know, you don't have a virtual camera that's doing impossible moves. Everything feels really rooted in reality, like you said.
I mean, I think that there's a stylistic choice to make when you make a film. And, I've seen some amazing shots that have been done. I mean, Dave Fincher has done some incredible shots that in Fight Club or that are impossible shots that go through the eye of cans and stuff like that. And they are fantastic. They've been conceived beautifully and they've been incredibly well executed. So I think there's value in that. And I love devising those shots. I love conceiving those shots and I love kind of shooting the elements for those shots. But when you're shooting something so larger than life, also, it's important, I think, to give the audience a grounding, because if you then suddenly start to become unreal with a situation that's unreal, I don't know. It's like it doesn't kind of work.
We had Gareth Edwards and Oren Soffer on recently talking about the creator, which I know that you collaborated with them on and helped figure out how that was going to be shot. I'm kind of curious these feel like two opposite production approaches, the kind of the guerrilla style run and gun of the creator, but it seems in opposition to Dune and that the look of that universe. But were there any aspects of what you guys figured out for the creator that you stole and then were able to utilize on Dune 2?
One of the great things about making a movie is that you have the benefit of multiple learned lessons from multiple learned people. You know, your first AD comes with his knowledge or her knowledge. Your producers come, your directors, everybody comes with their own knowledge. So if you combine everybody's understanding of the best practices, then you can sometimes learn from other people and give them back. And it's a really amazing, opportunity to learn from other people's experiences. So, one of the things that I love about filmmaking is when you manage to break the mold of what's normal and you can create something that's kind of outside of the box from a production standpoint. And, from Rogue One, Gareth and I mean, going back to Gareth, like the reason why I met Gareth or wanted to meet Gareth desperately when he was meeting for Rogue One was because I wanted to meet the guy that made Monsters. I wanted to meet that guy that did that film in that way. And I wanted to talk to him about it. Of course, I knew he was making Star Wars and I love Star Wars, passionate Star Wars fan. But to me, I wanted to meet him because of the filmmaker. And we got talking about Star Wars and, the rest was history. He asked me to do it and I was like, yes, of course. You had me at hello. we talked about that on Rogue about working away to make an entire film in a really small way. And we theorized the way to do that with cameras and equipment. On Dune, part one, we finished the film in Abu Dhabi. I don't know how much on my view I've spoken about this, but we finished the film in Abu Dhabi. We did Jordan first, then we did Budapest, and then we went to Abu Dhabi. And we finished in Abu Dhabi with 15 crew. I think it was literally three actors. I think it was Paul, Jessica, and Kynes as actors. And it was, nine crew people. And we effectively did sunrises and sunsets. And then in the middle of the day, we slept and hang out. But we capitalized on the dawns and the dusks for all the night scenes. And Denis and I talked at length about that. That was for us so successful because we were able to make amazing drama, but in a really honest, small way, like our independent film days. And that was before we did The Creator. So it all feeds into each other about the approach. But when we're on part two in Abu Dhabi, it was a bit of a bigger affair. We had more people because we're blowing things up and we're moving, spice harvester legs and all that stuff. But what we didn't forget was how much we endurance of the small unit and the small experience. So we effectively in Abu Dhabi did the same thing. Every morning we all went out, there was 10 of us, 12 of us. We did a small scene. Maybe it was with Stilgar and Paul and Fremen. You know, maybe it was kind of with Paul and Jessica. And in the evenings we did another small scene. Again, maybe it was Chani and Paul, you know, over the course of a week or something. And so we really capitalized on the fact that we could go from a small unit to a big unit, back to a small unit, all in the same day. And, you know, we had short days on that film because we're towards winter. And so the days get obviously shorter. And so we capitalized. We literally milked every single minute of daylight in Abu Dhabi. And so, you know, every film's a learning experience and you learn the pros and the cons. And I feel like I'm getting better at kind of briefing a crew, briefing a plan, to come up with a plan to make that small, intimate shoot, which is always fantastic for actors and always fantastic for the director. And I love it too.
I'm curious about your involvement in the grading process. Do you still work with David Cole?
Yes, very much so.
Tell me about your involvement with the grade. You know, obviously, I've seen the Dolby Vision theatrical grade. It's stunning and spectacular. So I'm kind of curious about, you know, how your role kind of continues on through the final finishing and that grading process.
One of the things I love about my collaborators, people like Dave Cole, for example, is that I trust him as a color artist. You know, I trust him. He is the extension of me, of Denis, of what this film is. And once we work out what this film needs from a color perspective, I feel like Dave is my guy doing those things. You know, I try not to micromanage the color. By the way, I'm very fussy when it comes to color. Like it's, you know, I've got a designer wife who has taught me many great things about color. And so I'm very fussy when it comes to color. And I feel like Dave is a great partner because he's able to take the fundamentals of what we build on set and on in dailies and in the prep that he helps with. And then he's able to then translate that to all the mediums that he works with, you know, from IMAX through to Dolby through to home video through like all those things. So I feel like, you know, giving him, it's like handing over a baby, you know, like it's, you hand it over and say, okay, got to go to bed at this time, got to be fed at this time. This is the way you, you know, dress him or her. Good. Okay. And then you close the door and go and have a good night out. But then I trust him to kind of look after the baby. So I think he's done a great job of that.
And tell me if this is true. So I heard, so you captured digitally on the Alexa, but then you actually did a film out to 35 and then brought that back in.
We did that on part one and we tested IMAX and film, IMAX film and film on part one. And we also tested digital and we found the film was not quite the look that we were after. And the digital wasn't quite, I mean, you know, doesn't work in a linear fashion, but neither of them were quite right. The film was too, as Denis put it, too nostalgic. The digital was a little too crisp and clear for the world. We wanted more texture and more patina and more texture. And the digital wouldn't give us that. So with Photochem, I've been testing a process of filming out, you know, my theory was like, okay, well, film has something to it. Like we know that. Filmmakers for generations have known film has something to it. So the question was, well, where does film get included in the process? Does it get included in the beginning or the middle or the end? Do you project in film or whatever that might be? So we tested it in the middle. We tested acquiring on digital and then putting it out to film, then scanning the film back in. And we did tests and, you know, it's an added process and it adds time and no one really wants to add time and money for no reason. But we did tests and it was night and day what it gave the film. Like it was night and day what it gave the highlights, what it gave the patina, what it gave the kind of the texture. And so we continued that on a part two. We went out to film negative and then scanned it back in. And, yeah, it created the look for the film. It becomes, you know, it's not just grain it gives you. In fact, it doesn't give you much grain because – it's one ASA film. It doesn't give you much grain. It's not the point of grain. Grain is a is one element of a much bigger thing that that film gives you. And any film loving like filmmaker will tell you that film has a certain je ne sais quoi, and it has. And some people will have a different response to different parts of it. Is it the grain? Is it the weave? Is it the noise? Is it the what is it? Is it the way that handles the highlights? Is it the way that handles the shadows? Whatever it is, film just added a really great element to this production. So it was a lovely little moment in the middle of having shot digitally. We could then do the film out.
Well, Greg, it is always a pleasure to have you on the show and to get your thoughts on the process and have you walk us through some of these sequences. Congratulations on Doom Part 2. It's a fantastic achievement. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
I really appreciate it. And I appreciate your passion for the movie because it's great to talk about it.
Absolutely. Many thanks to Greg for joining us on the podcast today. And an extra special thanks to our friends at Warner Brothers for helping us put this conversation together. If you'd like to check out Greg's other appearances on our Dolby podcast, we will have links to those episodes in our show notes. Dune Part 2 is now in theaters, and stunning Dolby Vision and Dolby Atmos were available. So if you can get a ticket to see the movie at a Dolby Cinema, you will not regret it. You can find links to tickets, as always, in our show notes. As I mentioned up top, this is just part one of our Dune Part 2 discussions this week, so be sure you are subscribed to us, the Dolby Creator Talks podcast, as you will not want to miss our upcoming conversation with composer Hans Zimmer. You can find that episode and even more conversations with artists and filmmakers about how they use technology to tell their stories by searching for Dolby wherever you get your podcasts. Links will also be in our show notes. If you're curious to know more about the Dolby Institute, head on over to dolbyinstitute.com. There you'll find information about all of our programs. You can access the entire library of episodes of this podcast, and you can sign up for our mailing list. Until next time, this is Dolby Creator Talks. I'm your host, Glenn Kaiser. Our producer and editor is Michael Coleman. Our executive producers are Amanda Schneider and Jack Ferry, with additional editing by Matt Nixon. And our production coordinator is Karen Marroquin. Thank you for joining us.